with more badass liberal talk. Bart Cop Radio.
You know, I'm certainly in no position to judge other people's writing talent because I'm an uneducated hack at best whose primary talent seems to be pounding out more drivel day after day after day than the other guy can. But I hate a really lazy writer. Me, I'm a liberal. I got excuses. I'm busy. I don't have time to sit down and write serious, long, thought-out dissertations on different subjects. I'm the Lucy at the candy factory. I'm the little hamster on the wheel, pumping his fastest, trying to do his best. But I hate a lazy writer. I just hate it. And the worst writers of all time are entertainment reviewers. I'm talking about music critics, TV critics, that kind of stuff. So I'm reading in the paper the other day, USA Today, greatest newspaper in my hand at the moment, had an article about a man who was really old, like 55, maybe not so old, maybe 40, and he's bonding with his 10-year-old son over the Beatles. And they made a big thing about yakety yakety. 30 years ago, he listened to Abbey Road, and now him and his son are sitting there listening to Abbey Road, and the kid, you know, he's all wide-eyed. What great music this is, Dad. I think probably the kid is working his dad for a raise on his daily allowance. But anyway, so this guy writes a story about a man and his son discovering and rediscovering the Beatles together. And the name of the article is All You Need Is Love, Father Bonds with Son Over Beatles, Memoirs, A Long Winding Road of Life's Lessons. I mean, how many horseshit cliches can you work into one title and subtitle? Oh, please. All you need is love and it's a long and winding road? Please. That proves you've heard of the Beatles before. That doesn't make you educated. That doesn't make you a star. It doesn't make you a writer. It doesn't make you someone with a valid opinion. It means you can name two Beatles songs. You crazy. What is this crazy whore's name? Edward Nawotka. Nawotka. Special for USA Today. Ooh, yeah, it sure was. But really, music critics are probably the worst. I've read some TV critics and some movie critics that weren't that bad, but music critics are the absolute worst. Don't remember if it was 95 or 98, we went to see Page and Plant. Followed them all around. We did Austin, Houston, Dallas. We did KC, St. Louis, Denver. We did all these little legs, you know, where we'd catch them three times in a weekend or whatever. And every review was the same. Each morning, you know, you wake up and you want to read the review of the show you saw the night before you leave town, get to the next town. And invariably, my new word, the headline would be something like, Page and Plant prove Stairway to Heaven delivers whole lot of love. It's like, oh, please, shoot me. How can you be that bad a writer? How is it possible to be that bad a writer? Oh, I'm cool. I'm tight with the lid, and I know two of the titles of their songs. It's like, well, what the hell did that prove? What's wrong with you, you idiot? Who is the idiot, A, that wrote it, and B, who is the editor that approved it? And if a separate third guy was the headline writer, he should be shot. No trial. Screw the Patriot Act. No trial, no lawyer. Just shoot him. He has to go right now. They just do it every time. There's now and then I'll read an article about a group I've never heard of. And you think, why are they forcing these awkward phrases into the review? They must be song titles is the only thing I can figure out because there's just no reason for that group of words to be associated with the rest of that sentence. It makes no sense. But why are music writers so incredibly and horribly cliched ridden and talentless? How much worse could it be? That's the bad news. Now we're going to talk about the good news. I saw some good writing the other day in Rolling Stone. Rolling Stone's got that bipolar thing going on where sometime they just sell out to the nth degree, calling NSYNC the greatest band in the world when they don't even play instruments. Yeah, I'm a band too. What's wrong with Rolling Stone? But now and then, they actually have real writers. I mentioned we had brief contact with a Rolling Stone writer. Well, it wasn't all that brief. And this guy, he could really write. I'm still negotiating with him. He sent me a sample of what he wrote about BarCop.com. And it was just, wow, this is a site I'd want to visit. And I asked him if I could print it. And he said, well, you can print it if you do X and Y. And I thought, well, I'm not hoop boy. I just wasn't in the mood for it. And I could just run it. But I don't know. Somewhere in the vast bowels, there's some ethics. But anyway, he wrote a really flattering, what do you call it, a treatment, 300-400 words about BarCop.com, and it just made me really sound good. Anyway, proving that Rolling Stone does have some writers, I want to read you one sentence of a review they did on The Sopranos. And before I praise this guy too much, he used the phrase, forget about it. Now, come on, that was really, really old in the year 2000. There should be a fine if you write about The Sopranos anytime after the January 1st, 2000, and you use the phrase, forget about it, you really are just, you go down from an A to a B. So all I can give this guy for this piece is a B. But I want you to check out his writing and the sting of his words. Oh, the sting. I like the sting of his words. He says, well, I should probably read more of that to give you some flavor where this is going. You'd think after five seasons, David Chase's landmark gangster series would sag, Gandolfini would be walking through his role, and the scripts would settle into repetition and formula. Forget about it. Now, see, there he goes. Okay. But as he closes out, he says, on the job front, Tony mixes it up with mob pals just released from prison. They include his cousin, played by Steve Buscemi, the great Steve Buscemi, with a comic spark that invigorates the series. Miss the shit out of him, says Tony. Nothing has changed about The Sopranos. Check this out. It's still daredevil television that shames Hollywood for trafficking in cowardly drool. That's so good. I get a Woody reading the words. Sopranos is still daredevil television that shames Hollywood for trafficking in cowardly drool. Is that not great writing? That's exactly what's coming out of Hollywood. What, The Sopranos, you got the West Wing, you got maybe a CSI or two, the occasional Joan of Arcadia, maybe you got your favorite comedies and dramas that you think are well written, but surely you'd agree with me that 95% of what comes out of Hollywood is just, what's he call it? Cowardly drool. These sitcoms they come up with. There's not a laugh in the entire half hour, and they dare try to pass that off as entertainment. I really appreciate this kind of writing. I can appreciate it. The guy wrote about 150 words. You know, I can't do these long books. That's why you people use some of these 60-page emails and say, you didn't print it all. Well, yeah, I got a life to live. I can't go 60 pages, and everybody who thinks they know something. But to put 150 words together and end with shames Hollywood for trafficking and cowardly drool, that's my kind of writer, and they don't even give his name. That is a shame. That really bad writer, they gave his name, but they didn't give this guy's name. But good for Rolling Stone. Sometimes they get it right, sometimes they don't. This segment is called I Love It When I'm Wrong. Last radio show, just hours after it got posted on the site, I was forced to reverse a position, and I love when I do that. I said, talking about the comedians, oh, and very bad on me for not mentioning Eddie Izzard as one of the top comics. He's got to be in the top five. But I mentioned in there that people like Ben Stiller and some others, they seem to have made their career on the dog bit my crotch and fart jokes and poop jokes, and I just wish comedy could grow up a little bit. Well, boy, did I have to eat my words. The next night on Joan of Arcadia, this was very well done. I'm going to try to give you a quick rundown, but also I'm going to try to do it with a few mistakes, because the only way we're going to increase radio production is if we just have the warts and all version, because it takes hours to go back and pull out all the uhs in there. Joan is your smart-ass teenager, talks directly to God, gives him a bunch of gruff. She has a younger brother who is a science nerd. He's a genius. She has an older brother who was paralyzed from the chest down. He can move his arms, but he can't move his, you know, he can't feel his chest, whatever. Dad's a cop who sometimes is chief of police, sometimes he's a detective, sometimes he gets demoted. Dad, he's got drama problems. Kevin, the older brother, the paraplegic, they've always made a big issue out of his being in a wheelchair and how resentful he is and how filled with rage he is and how he's just mad at the world and he was a star athlete, yada yada. Now he can't move his legs. And they told him it's sort of within the realm of possibility that one day you might get a little feeling back, but it's a 1 out of 10,000 at best. And of course, early on, every time Joan would talk to God, she'd say, "Why don't you just cure my little brother?" And God would say, "It doesn't work that way." Okay. God's a mystery. Okay. So, Kevin told his brother he thought he felt a little something. He said it felt kind of like gas in my chest, and that's unusual. I haven't felt anything like that before. So he said, "I'm going to go to the doctor and check it out." And they warned him. They said, "You know, don't get your hopes up." But he said, "Hey, I got to check it out." So he goes to the doctor, and the doctor said, "We already told you, you know, this is a 1 in 10,000. You can't, every time you think you might have a feeling, you can't run over here and have us run these tests." And he said, "Please, you got to run the tests." Okay. So they do the rest of the show. And as they're closing the show, they're all gathered around the supper table, everybody but Mom. So they're sitting there. And the older brother in the wheelchair sticks his finger out to his little brother and says, "Pull my finger." And the science geek looks at him with that look like, "Oh, please, do you think I'm going to fall for that?" And he goes, "Seriously, pull my finger." And he still looked at him, but anyway, make a longer story shorter, he finally gave a little pull, and when he did, the guy in the wheelchair farted. And they all looked at each other like, "What is that? Why would Kevin do that at the supper table? This is not like him. It's weird behavior. I mean, if you're going to be that weird, you wouldn't do it with your parents there, and certainly not at the dinner table." So he asked his brother, "Pull it again." And he pulled it a second time, and he farted again. Then it dawned on him what that meant. It meant he could control himself down there, as be one way to put that. So they're all sitting there stunned. Mom walks in, and he says, "Mom," says, "Mom, pull my finger." And she looks at him like, everyone in this room has got the stupidest look on their face, and now my son, who's an adult, wants me to pull his finger? What? So he says, "No, seriously, Mom, pull my finger." She pulls his finger. He farts again. She right away knew what it meant. So all of a sudden, the paraplegic, the 1 in 10,000, has come true. God won't be claiming any credit for this, probably. This is how they closed the last show. But I just thought it was striking that hours after I pretty much said all fart jokes are useless and pointless and why do people use them, mere hours after that, we got a tasty fart joke. That I just thought that was funny. I love to be wrong. Joan of Arcadia is a good show. Check it out sometime. There's a TV show called The Practice. You've probably heard of it. Sunday nights, ABC. The show itself is disintegrating for economic reasons. They're going to keep the new guy and the two unknown girls and fire the rest of the cast because they're all making too much money. And that's kind of understandable, but it's also kind of sad because there were times when The Practice was a good show. David E. Kelly often can write a good show. Sometimes he doesn't, but often he can. And the last Practice that was on dealt with free speech zones that Tommy and I mentioned in the last show.
On March 7th, there was a presidential motorcade in Boston. Hundreds of thousands of people came out. Some carrying signs in support of the commander-in-chief, some waving placards in protest. The ones protesting were removed under the threat of arrest. The ones in support were allowed to stay. What's happening to us? I realize we live in a different world since 9/11. Certain liberties we just have to forfeit. search our luggage at airports, conduct racial profiling, put up cameras to watch us on street corners. None of us like any of it, but we have to understand. But silence our voices? Make it a crime to engage in political dissent? Segregate people based on the content of their ideas? And it's not just going on in the government. Let's look at television. The Super Bowl, for example. They bombarded us with ads on beer, erectile dysfunction. It's okay to see dogs biting crotches and farting donkeys, let alone the halftime show. But a spot containing political content, that has to be shut down. What is happening to this country? Historically, we have always been a nation that has championed the idea. Today, if the government doesn't like your idea, you can be cordoned off to a designated zone where it is guaranteed to get no exposure. It goes against America, against the Constitution, against the principles we fought for in every war throughout our nation's history. Of course, Carrie Moses felt rage. Where's yours? Where's yours? And yours? Edward R. Murrow once said, "We must never confuse dissent with disloyalty." We have either become a country of oppression, or we are just very, very confused. As Carrie herself said, "Free speech zone? Why isn't the whole country a free speech zone?"
Madam Foreperson, the jury has reached a unanimous verdict.
We have, Your Honor.
Will the defendant please rise? What say you?
In the matter of the Commonwealth versus Carrie Moses, on the charge of aggravated assault against a police officer, we find the defendant, Carrie Moses, guilty.
Ms. Moses, you've been found guilty. Now, on a matter of sentencing...
Hold on. We're doing sentencing now?
Yes, we are, Miss Frutt. The crime for which you have been convicted is very serious, and the court takes it seriously. And accordingly, I sentence you to 8 years to be served at Cedar Junction.
8 years maximum security?
People need to know they just can't go around openly criticizing our government, eroding our national unity. This is America, Ms. Moses. You dissent, you go to prison. 8 years. Cedars. Adjourn.
Eleanor, I'll lose my kids. I mean, how could he do that? How can I
get... Take it easy, Carrie. That ruling was tailor-made for a reversal. It's almost as if he wanted to...
And with that, Eleanor looked up and caught the judge's eye, and he kind of gave her a little nod to let her know she was on the right track. You see, in TV land, the good guy wins. In real life, the crooked judges overrule sanity and precedent, and they just give it to their buddies. Hopefully, this will change someday soon. It would be nice.
Bart Cop. He's better than a sharp stick in the ear.